So I'm going to call a committee to order. This is Senate Committee on General Government Accountability for Wednesday, March 8th. And we're going to not go in order of the agenda. We're going to start with Senate Bill 89, then we're going to do Senate Bill 254, then 113, then 91. So, Cheyenne?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 89 modifies provisions governing collection of delinquent accounts owed state agencies. It directs the Department of Revenue to offer its delinquent accounts for assignment to private collections agencies, requires other state agencies to offer delinquent accounts to DOR only instead of to either DOR or private collections agencies, requires DOR to offer those accounts to private collection agencies when inactive for 6 months, clarifies that DOR's collections unit may access all information in DOR's possession for lawful purposes, becomes operative July 1st, 2018, declares emergency effective on passage. There is a -1 amendment that removes the emergency clause, and there is a -2 amendment that makes clarifying and technical changes, permits DOR the discretion to assign other agencies delinquent accounts to private collections during the first 6 months, requires DOR to notify the originating agency if and when the debt is assigned to private collections, directs DOR to provide private collections entities with written standards of service, and it provides that originating state agencies may cancel and recall uncollectible assignments to DOR and shall recall such assignments to private collections, restores language requiring certain content in notices to debtors when setoffs are made.
Rip Gumberg, welcome.
Thank you very much, Chair Riley and members of the committee. For your record, I am David Gomberg from House District 10 on the Central Oregon coast, and I'm very pleased to be here today to support Senate Bill 89. Now, let me say Senate Bill 89 is not my bill. As you well know, it was actually crafted by DAS, but I have been working on this delinquent debt issue for some time, and I think that what you have before you is an important tool that we can use to begin to get a better handle on an important and substantial problem. And I wanted to take just a moment to give you my sense of how substantial this problem is and what kind of real dollars are out there on the table. I'm looking over the report that was just issued by Legislative Fiscal on delinquent debt for 2016. The top five agencies that are owed money by Oregonians, include the Employment Department with $161 million, Health Sciences University with $179 million, the Justice Department with $397 million, the Department of Revenue, which is carrying $629 million, and the Judicial Department with $1.6 billion. Those are the top five, Mr. Chair, which leaves about another $300 million over in other agencies. And I think that's really a very interesting part of this conversation. If we talk about sending all debt to the Department of Revenue, we're talking about a number of small agencies like the Appraiser Certification and Licensing Board, which has $300,000 out there in receivables. The Construction Contractors Board's got $6 million. The Landscape Contractors Board, $578,000. The Mortuary and Cemetery Board is owed $156,000, and I submit to you that the Mortuary and Cemetery Board does not have a robust collection effort under their roof. And what we have learned in asking agency after agency about their delinquent debt is for a lot of them, they don't have the resources to pursue it, and it's not a priority for them to pursue it. And many cases we're also seeing that that we simply don't measure their effectiveness on how well they pursue those dollars. In total right now, the delinquent debt that Oregonians owe the state of Oregon is just a hair shy of $3.3 billion. It's billion with a B. And that represents over 2.5 million different individuals that owe us money. So sending this over to revenue, I think, is going to provide us with a number of tools that we can use. The first tool is we get it all in the same place, and that way we find out if there's an individual or an enterprise that owes money across a series of different agencies, and we can begin to consolidate that. Once we begin to consolidate it, I think then we have better tools to address one of the problems that I find most frustrating, and that is the situation where an agency is owed money and a different agency has hired that same enterprise to do work for them, so we're paying money out to people that owe us money because our computer systems are uncommunicative and we're not able to actually get the big picture on all of this debt. Another thing that I think is an important benefit that we have by sending the issue over to revenue is they have tools that most agencies do not. They actually have the ability to attach people's tax refunds to repay some of the debt that's owed. Now, I want to caution you that when we send this load over to revenue, we need to make sure that we provide them with the human resources that are necessary to begin collecting it, or they're going to farm most of it out to collection agencies. I've got no problem with private collection agencies, but they do not have this important tool of being able to attach tax refunds in order to satisfy debt. There's a couple of other questions that are in play here, and one of them has to do with our public universities. Does this bill cover our public universities? It's not clear to me, but I think the answer is probably not. And I'm looking over our public universities, and I'm seeing in most cases they are carrying debt of anywhere from $15 to $20 million each. Interestingly, Western Oregon University right now is got the highest debt with $19,687,000. One of the questions I would ask is whether they have the ability to withhold diplomas from people that haven't paid all their bills. Another question that is out there has to do with agencies that have that do in fact have a robust collection process in place. Yesterday in General Government Subcommittee of Ways and Means, we heard from PERS. And PERS started the year with $114 million in receivables. They finished the year with about $70 million. And I asked them how they're making that kind of progress when most agencies actually are losing ground. And the answer is, quite simply, that they've got a payout process, and they're taking a little bit out of future payoffs to recover overpayments that have occurred in the past. That's a good process, and we need to make sure we don't take that tool away from agencies that have tools like that. Another aspect of this problem is the debt that we are actually writing off in total. I was a little bit startled when I first encountered a situation where an agency was writing off debt, and I asked PERS yesterday why they had written off about $100,000 in debt last year, and they said, well, the answer to that is that the people they were trying to collect from had passed away. Well, there's always something, Mr. Chairman. Yes, we do have debt that is written off, and astoundingly, to the tune of about $100 million a year that we're just simply taking off the books. That's of concern to me. So I think we've got some tools here. I think that that moving this debt to one place is a good and productive change. Those of us on Ways and Means need to make sure that they have the tools there, the people there, to actually begin to recover this debt once we give it all to them, because I don't want to see $3 billion land on revenue with a thud and them not knowing what to do with it. And the other thing we'd have to do then once it gets there is to measure their progress in collecting it with a key performance measure so that we actually get some reporting back on how we're doing in addressing this pervasive problem. Appreciate you taking up the bill today. Be happy to answer any questions.
Yes, Senator Persansky.
The only thing I'd say is that when we rely on a private agency for collecting a state debt or a public debt, we lose money because they're going to take 40 to 50% off the top is what I understand. Not saying that that's not an alternative, but it does seem to me that if we can actually recapture it within our own system, we get a better return for our money.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Persansky, I agree with you. There's some interesting statistics and details in play as to the success ratios of in-house state agencies versus private collection firms, also the split between the firms that we hire that are in-state or out of state. That's a very interesting question, and I keep falling back on this this fact that if we're going to send this debt someplace like revenue, we need to make sure that they have enough people to actually administer it, or else they're just going to shovel it all out the door.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
So Daz is signed up. Lindsay, do you want to? And yes. Please join us as well.
Good afternoon, Chair Riley, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lindsay Baker, and I am the Government Relations Director at the Department of Administrative Services. It's sort of hard to follow Representative Gomberg's remarks, but I will try to be detailed and brief at the same time. So, Senate Bill 89, I want to be really clear, is just one small step to addressing the problems as were articulated by Representative Gomberg. So right now, agencies, executive branch agencies, have a 90-day period after a debt after they are receiving no payments on debts to refer out to they have a choice, right? So they can either refer out to Department of Revenue after that 90-day window, or they can refer it to a private collection firm. Senate Bill 89 eliminates that option such that it requires agencies to refer immediately to Department of Revenue, and they can no longer refer to a PCF. So that is, again, at the very high level, all the bill attempts to do. The Dash 2 amendments that you see before you are really some sort of housekeeping and cleanup measures to not substantively change the bill, but really just clarify what the original intent was. So again, we're making sure that revenue is providing notice to the agency where the debt originated when it's going to be signed out to a private collection firm. Allowing the Department of Revenue to assign out to a PCF before that, you know, within that six-month window, if they deem that that would be most appropriate. Clarifying the existing process for how revenue would engage in an offset mechanism. Clarifying that private collection firms are subject to the same standards of confidentiality as Department of Revenue. And then one other piece I'll mention briefly that is not articulated, it's not explicitly captured in the Dash 2 amendments, but which is our intent, is this issue of existing assignments out to private collection firms. So I know that there's been some concern from Justice and from Revenue and from private collection firms. What do we do with the debts that are currently assigned out? Do we want to recall them and then reissue them? And the answer to that is no. This is intended only to be on a go-forward basis, so any debts that originate an agency that meet this criteria effective of January of next year will be subject to this, but all of the existing assigned debts are not. So that's sort of the details of what the amendments do, and happy to answer any questions or provide any clarifying information if that's helpful to the committee.
Deanna?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue, and I'm just here to answer questions, be Lindsay's wingman on this bill. It's obviously something that we've worked with them on, and our agency's okay with and able to administer.
You're able to administer, but you're going to need more people? Is that, or can you do it with?
Mr. Chair, there would be a fiscal with this bill. I believe we're asking for revenue agents to increase the volume. I believe DAS has estimated that there's about 100,000 accounts that would come to us, and that would require, or about 100,000 accounts that are subject to it, and about 35,000 that would come to us upon the operative date of the bill. And so that would be, there'd be, I think, eight positions that they asked for that are just collectors and some support positions as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
Other questions? Thank you very much. So I'm going to close a public hearing on Senate Bill 89, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 254. Cheyenne?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 254 requires financial institutions to use the Department of Revenue's data match system once per quarter to identify delinquent debtors' accounts, requires DOR to pay financial institutions as specified, and permits reimbursement to be sought from debtors with specified notice, provides exceptions for certain institutions and immunity from liability for institutions complying in good faith, prohibits DOR from acting on delinquent child support obligations enforced by the Department of Justice, permits agreements internal to DOJ and between DOJ and DOR concerning such information as specified, prohibits disclosure of transmitted information to delinquent debtor, and other unauthorized use or disclosure of transmitted information as specified, authorized DOR to impose civil penalty of up to $1,000 against noncompliant financial institutions in certain circumstances, up to $2,500 for prohibited disclosures to delinquent debtors, and up to $1,000 for other unauthorized disclosures to be credited to the general fund, creates a Class C felony for unauthorized use or disclosure of transmitted information by a state officer or employee, directs dismissal of such officer or employee, and prohibits them from public office for 5 years, authorizes DOR rulemaking in consultation with banking, credit union, and Department of Consumer and Business Services representatives, becomes operative July 1, 2018, declares emergency effective on passage, and there is a Dash 1 amendment that removes the emergency clause.
Senators Taylor, Johnson, and bring up anyone.
Chief, from the Secretary of State's office.
Yes, please.
Chair Riley, I'm for the committee. I'm Kathleen Taylor, State Senator for District 21. Before I start, I want to give some credit where credit is due. This bill is the result of an audit that was done by the Secretary of State's office and largely done by Ms. Jamie Rawls here. So there are two concepts in this bill, and they have been thoroughly, thoroughly vetted and gone through the entire auditing process. So I just wanted to preface my statement with that. I'm here today to request your support for Senate Bill 254, a bill which will give the Department of Revenue two meaningful tools to improve efficiency in order to collect debt owed to the state of Oregon. Liquidated and delinquent debt owed to the state has nearly doubled since 2008 to $3.3 billion. Over $600 million of this is within the Department of Revenue. During the 2015 regular session, the legislature passed Senate Bill 55, which took steps to improve collection efforts, including centralizing debt collection oversight within DAS. In conjunction, the Secretary of State's office released the State Debt Collection Audit, which included a series of recommendations, among them using data matching processes and new hire report data to issue garnishments more efficiently. Currently, if the Department of Revenue issues a garnishment on a debtor's bank account, they must guess at which institution a debtor may be banking. Each garnishment that is issued has a quote-unquote search fee payable to the financial institution and added to the debtor's balance. This method is inefficient and not cost-effective, as there are fees associated with each one of these requests. As well, financial institutions have to search their records for possible accounts of people that might not bank with them in ad hoc, unscheduled manner. The Division of Child Support, DCS, and DOJ currently uses FIDM to issue levies and collect unpaid child support. Senate Bill 254 follows the audit recommendation that Oregon create a statute to allow for Department of Revenue to issue FIDM similarly to DOJ. The bill requires financial institutions to participate in a data match system established by the Department of Revenue to identify accounts held by delinquent debtors. Matches will take place on a quarterly basis. Individual financial institutions will be reimbursed by DOR for startup costs up to $2,500 and for quarterly costs up to $150. Exemptions exist if this program would not be cost effective to administer or a financial institution is experiencing financial hardship. Directs a rulemaking advisory committee to convene to determine the appropriate procedures for the multitude of financial institutions that exist in Oregon and require a representative from the bank and from the credit unions to be part of the rulemaking process. It penalizes misuse and disclosure of data match information for financial institutions, their employees, and state agency employees to ensure accountability in keeping debtor information private. The other portion of the bill deals with what is known as new hire report. Under federal child support law, employers are required to submit lists of new and rehired employees to state child support collectors. Currently, DOR is not explicitly allowed access to the information in the report. Senate Bill 254 follows the audit recommendation to grant Department of Revenue access to the state data, which will assist with wage garnishment and locate wage earners who are not paying taxes earlier than we can currently with other existing payroll reports. Senate Bill 254, new hire report sharing, authorizes the Division of Child Support to share information on new and rehired employees with DOR for the purpose of wage garnishment. And I think that's about it. Deanna Mack, there's a small fiscal of about $250,000, but the revenue impact, this is a very conservative estimate because this would be something new that we haven't done before. So for the first biennium, it'll be around $2 million coming into the state. Then this next biennium, $8.3 million. And then the third biennium, $10 million. Again, conservative estimates since it would be a new program that we don't know exactly how much money it would bring into the state. So, and then we have, of course, Senator Johnson, who I've worked very closely with on this.
I really have very little substantive to add other than to acknowledge then Representative Taylor, now Senator Taylor's extremely hard work on this bill last session. And the fact that we are bringing ostensibly an identical bill, she has worked diligently with the banking industry to work through some of their issues. And I think that this is a bill that continues to nibble away at the amount of debt owed the state of Oregon, a staggering $3 plus billion. So I am here as part of the Gomberg-Taylor entourage on collections, and I will leave it to the technical experts from the Secretary of State's office. The one thing I would add is that often the professional auditors over at the Secretary of State's office produce audits and they make recommendations. This bill actually follows up on one of those recommendations. I think it's incumbent upon us when we've spent the money, expended the energy, professionals have scrubbed the issue, and they come back to us and say, do X, Y, Z. We're delivering X, Y, Z to you in the form of this fine piece of public policy. I commend it for your consideration.
Thank you, Senator. Ms. Rawls.
Thank you, Chair Riley, members of the committee. For the record, my name's Jamie Rawls. I'm a principal auditor at the Secretary of State Audits Division. I'm a certified fraud examiner and also a certified data analyst, and I was the lead auditor on this performance audit that was completed September of 2015. The objective, or for today's presentation, I want to give just a brief background on the specific two tools that are into the bill, the access to the new hire report and the bank data matching. And then open it up for any questions if you have any. The objective of our audit was to determine if Oregon can improve the collection of liquidated and delinquent debt. And specifically, we wanted to know if there were promising practices that other states were doing that Oregon could replicate and improve collections here. The impetus for the audit was a five-year trend of increasing delinquent debt, declining collection rates, and lack of a statewide leadership overseeing the collection of delinquent debt. To determine best practices, we interviewed officials from the U.S. Department of Treasury and 15 states that were focused on collection best practices. From those interviews, we identified five best practice themes and narrowed our focus to six different states that all made improving collections a sustained priority and had similar demographics to Oregon and, like Oregon, had a state income tax. So the six states were Colorado, Kentucky, Maryland, New Jersey, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. Through our research and discussion with other states and interviews with Oregon officials, we found tools that Oregon could pursue to increase collections. Two of the tools we listed in our audit report were the bank account levies, the bank matching, and access to the DOJ new hire report. So on the new hire report, under federal child support law, employers are required to submit lists of new employees within roughly 20 days of hire for use by child support collectors. And the Employment Department also receives a quarterly employer data on employees and wages, but it's often 3 to 6 months lag after the hiring, so it's not timely. We found only three collection units had access to the more timely new hire information, which was the DOJ Child Support Unit, the Employment Department, and the Office of Payment and Recovery, which is shared services by DHS and OHA. DOR, in our interviews and discussions with them, had mentioned in interviews they'd like to receive the new hire report and believe it would improve their ability to garnish wages and identify wage earners who had not filed taxes. DOR's research indicated back then that eight state taxing authorities had access to the new hire information, and those states included California and North Carolina, who appeared to be in similar legal position as Oregon. DOR first identified the issue back in 2012 and had planned to seek legislation authorizing its access. However, as of August 2015, when we were wrapping up the end of our audit, we had learned that DOJ officials still had not responded back to DOR's request for legal clarity. And we first recommended expanded access to this back in 1997 in one of our audit reports. As speed is critical to collections, access to that new hire report could allow agencies to garnish wages they might not have known about, and it could also let collectors know of the debtor location. The bank data matching, when it comes to bank garnishment and levies, we found all but one of Oregon's largest debtor agencies have to guess where the debtor might be banking. As was mentioned, you know, they have to guess and maybe be sourced to fees associated with that. Other states, including Wisconsin and California, had worked with financial institutions to implement a broader statewide matching system that allowed them to quickly link debtors to specific bank accounts. In Oregon, we learned the only agency that can match debtors to bank balances for collections is the Department of Justice Child Support Program. And federal law required all states to access bank information for child support debt. But other Oregon agencies had to send requests to banks where they believed the debtor might be banking. If there was a match and required authorizations in place, the bank would take the money from the debtor's account and send it to the agency. Sometimes collectors have canceled checks and other clues that they can get to guess where they're banking. But typically, it's based on the last known address, and this lack of information deters the filing of bank levies, which carries fees. Other states, we found through the audit process, had created bank account matching systems that go beyond child support. The systems allowed them to send levies to banks with much more confidence that the debtor money is actually there.
From our interviews with Wisconsin, we learned its statewide system includes data from about 500 banks operating in the state, and the state law requires them to participate. Wisconsin works with a third-party data manager that matches the state debtor information to the bank data, and this particular vendor works in at least 37 other states for some kind of financial institutional data matching. And up to 11 of those states conduct matching for purposes other than child support, such as tax debt or other debt. It's largely automated and requests to banks when matches are found. Wisconsin's annual report on delinquent debt showed about $30 million in 2014 bank levy collections alone, which was roughly 15% of their total collections. So it was by far one of the largest collection tools that we found, the most successful. From review of those two tools and others, the audit report recommended Oregon consider the use of those collection tools by working with agencies and the legislature when necessary to implement.
Questions?
I'm happy to answer any questions.
I guess I do have a question. So I wasn't really clear. Thank you. It sounds pretty efficient. So they find out where a debtor banks, then what? Are you actually, like, taking money out of the account at that point, or what does that happen? Okay.
You want to better answer that, or me?
I think either of us can answer, but yeah. So, in Oregon, we actually have a Debtor Protection Act. So we have there are statutes that protect an individual, obviously. So we don't just obviously go after somebody unless it's proven that they have not paid the debt, and then there has to go through a process and a writ of garnishment. You have to be at that point. And then once that's all determined, and then if we have this tool, then we'd be able to more efficiently find out where, you know, in this case, Taylor has an account, and then yes, the state would require that the account be garnished. But there's a lot of things that are taken into consideration. So if there's only a certain amount of money in the account, whatever the income is that's coming in there, and et cetera. So if you owed $1,000, but you only had $2,000 in the account, the state would not necessarily take the whole $1,000 at that time. They would take maybe part of it, or it would depend on what the income source is, because we don't want the person to be destitute. Does that make sense?
One follow. Yes, it does make sense.
And the Department of Revenue is here. They probably can answer more correctly if I said anything wrong, and maybe I did. I mean, you said a few things wrong, but I think I got it right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue. And to the question, what the department would do is we would eventually issue a garnishment. There are protections in Chapter 18 currently that protects different types of income and different types of balances that we can't get to, that no agency can get to. And I think that's what Senator Taylor's talking about there. That is not in this bill. That is current law. And we would follow those current procedures in the debt collection chapters in Chapter 18.
So I'm guessing it'd be similar to what a child, whatever it's called, with
child
the DOJ.
Support.
Yes, thank you, child support. When they send a notice of garnishment to an employer to withhold a certain amount to get it sent in. So it's similar to
Mr.
that.
Chair, Senator Thatcher, yeah, they have withholding orders, and we have notices of garnishment. They're similar. We have... There's protected income, there's Social Security, disability, those kinds of things. All of that stuff in a bank account is protected. And then wages are protected up to 75% of the amount that of disposable income.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for the explanation.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Mike Ritchie? No coaching.
Senator Riley, members of the committee, my name is Mike Ritchie. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Department of Justice. I work full-time as the general counsel for the Oregon Child Support Program. We worked closely with Department of Revenue in crafting both of the concepts that are included in Senate Bill 254. The Department of Justice is supportive of this bill. They're an important partner agency. They assist the Division of Child Support a great deal in collecting support, and we believe that this bill, if passed, would increase collections in Oregon. The one piece I will point out is that the Department of Revenue was very careful to make sure that this bill would not impair the collection of child support. So if it identifies an account for someone who owes past due child support, they basically wait 30 days to give the Division of Child Support a head start to go try and get that money first, so it can still be taken for child support. At the end of that 30 days, they can issue their garnishment to see if there's additional money that would be subject to the writ of garnishment. So with that said, I'd be happy to answer any questions if anyone has any.
Don't see any.
Thank you very much. The opportunity.
So that's all I have signed up for this bill. Is there anybody else who would like to speak? Come on up. I'm surprised you're interested in this bill.
Well, you never know, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association and the Independent Community Banks of Oregon. First of all, I do want to give a very sincere thank you to Senator Taylor, then as Senator Johnson mentioned, then Representative Taylor, as well as Senator Johnson and the Department of Revenue for working with the Bankers Association on this bill. You folks in the Senate didn't deal with this issue in 2016, but I can tell you that I dealt with it almost on a daily basis with Senator Taylor and the Department of Revenue. We committed to both of them after the session that we would work on this issue in the interim, and I think Department of Revenue would tell you we've done that. They have a similar bill in the House that was introduced that is based on the discussions that we had with them. And this bill that you have before you today is very similar to that. As you've heard, and it might be identical, I'm not sure. As you've heard, you know, the idea for this comes from the federally enacted child support legislation of a few years ago, and indeed some other states have adopted a data match program. And certainly I think the first thing I want to say is banks, this will surprise nobody, I hope, banks want and expect their customers to pay all their bills, including what they owe in taxes. You know, that's how banks make money, by making loans and getting paid back. So it is important that everybody pay their bills. We are, however, always hesitant when given new police powers. You know, we would just like the 10 to 3 days are certainly gone, but we would just like to be bankers and not be part of a police program and our collection program for others. Having said that, because of the efforts that Senator Taylor and Johnson, and I believe Representative Nathanson is also on this bill in the Department of Revenue, we have found ourselves in a neutral position. They have made many, many changes, which again, we're very, very grateful. The only thing that I would point out, we are neutral. We're not opposed to the bill. I want that very, very clear, is that it will allow the department to collect on all bill, or not just taxes, but anything they collect for. And let me give you just one example. I have a friend, not saying who it is, but I had a friend who got a parking ticket in Portland. For those of you that aren't in Portland, it's $60 or $75 for a parking ticket. It's certainly not cheap. They did not pay it. They did not pay it. They did not pay it. Ultimately, it went to the Department of Revenue for collection because the city of Portland does contract out their collections to the Department of Revenue. As I understand the bill, and if I understand Department of Revenue from previous testimony in 16, they could indeed use this policy to collect that type of debt. So from a policy perspective, I believe this may go farther than some states have, and you know, would suggest perhaps the collecting of tax revenue might be a good start. But again, we are neutral. I just throw that out for policy consideration, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Don't see any. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anybody else? All right. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 254. Thank you all for. So I'm going to move to Senate Bill. What did I say? 91.
91's work session.
Oh yeah. So 13. Yeah. Let's go to Senate Bill 113, and I'm going to open a public hearing on that. I'm going to pass this over. And I'm going to testify on this one.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 113, requires unredeemed balances on gift cards inactive for at least 5 years to be transferred to the Department of State Lands.
We already opened the public hearing.
It's not too often you get the chair in the hot seat.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chuck Riley. I'm a senator for Senate District 15, Hillsborough, Corneas, Forest Grove, North Plains, and a bunch of farms in the middle. This bill is a pretty simple bill. It requires that anyone who issues a gift card, if that gift card has not been used in a period of 5 years or more, to turn that amount of money that's left on that card to the state lands and put in their account that people can look up online, find if they have some money in there, and retrieve it. Currently, that money stays with the corporation that has issued the card. The account that this would go into in state lands, the interest goes to the school fund, and that's a much better place for it, in my opinion. And it also makes it available for anyone who discovers that, hey, I have a gift card. If it has identifying number on it, and most of them do, then they can look on state lands, discover that card is available for payment, and fill out the forms and get the money. I'm available for questions.
Anybody have any questions? Senator.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, the 5 years, what was the basis for that, understanding that there's other statutes that have different time frames, I believe, for banks and stuff? It's 7 years, I believe. I have to check that, but I thought there's a difference disparity as to what's drafted for here versus what is required from other financial institutions.
Yeah, the reason I picked 5 years is because it was a good number and not because of anything else.
Okay. Yes.
Thank you. Is this just Oregon companies? I mean, how would this work? You know, I think Nordstrom, Safeway.
Yeah, I think we probably have somebody here who can answer that better. But State Lands Department has agreements with other states, and basically it goes to the state where the corporation is housed. So we wouldn't get all the ones from the people who get cards here. That money would probably go, depending on where that corporation is housed, if we have that agreement with that state, it would probably go there. And any corporations in this state, from those states, would that money would come here.
Follow up, yes.
Well, when I think of, if that's the case, most gift cards that are in circulation are from big corporations, Target, Nordstrom, Safeway, out of state. Mm-hmm. So that really limits the field here.
It does. And there is... I think there may be someone here who can, you know, explain that a little better.
I have hand waving in the back, but we'll let them testify in a minute.
Talk about that.
Are you signed up on the list?
I have submitted a written testimony.
Great, that's fine. If you'll identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, committee chair and members of the committee. My name is Patrick Tate. I am the trust property manager for the Department of State Lands, and can maybe answer technical questions. I've submitted written testimony. The department's neutral on the bill, but I'm here to answer any questions you may have of the particulars of how our law works.
Yes, Senator.
Thank you. I don't know if you would know be even the person to ask about this, but what universe of money are we talking about? What's the amount that we're talking about?
I would not know that for sure.
Yeah.
There are some, in my testimony, we do have, believe there could be some technical issues around how we define cardholder and the who would report the actual unclaimed gift card balance to us. All states operate under a rule of custody set out originally by the U.S. Supreme Court from fights between custody between states on who should get unclaimed property. And so in this case, I think most of the gift cards will be bearer instruments. And so it would generally fall under the rules of custody we operate under to the state of incorporation, if that's of assistance.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is also an indeterminate revenue impact, so there's not a good understanding of what the number might be, and it's posted on the holds.
I have a question.
Yes.
Now I'm going to go blank. What currently in our business, when we have checks that are that have not been cashed, there's a period of time when we turn those to the Department of State Lands. Do you know what that time period is?
Thank you for the question, Senator DeBoer and committee chair. My understanding with uncashed checks is generally a three-year abandonment. It kind of depends on who's reporting it to us. Public entities, public agencies would report after 2 years generally, but most others it's 3 year abandonment.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Yeah, one more. So if somebody decided, okay, they found their little gift card, ironically, last night I found an Amazon gift card that I'd given away for Christmas, or thought I had purchased to give away for Christmas, and there it was. And I really don't know how old it is, but if I were to redeem it and then Amazon says, I'm sorry, it's no longer there. So then I go to state lands. What's the process for reclaiming it?
Okay. Thank you for the question, Senator Riley and Senator Thatcher. Understanding would be in most cases we would go to depending on how it was originally submitted to us. If we have a name and address, it's a fairly straightforward process. The person can go online, find their name, and submit a claim, actually create a claim online. In a case where there would not be a name associated to it, if there's an identifying number reported, we would use that, and the person can contact us, say, the retailer has said that it was reported to you, I want to reclaim the funds, and we would create a claim for that person and start that process off. And so and once that happens, it depends on the amount of the exact process, but generally what we ask for is something to identify that person is connected to that. That may be the an email you got back from Amazon in that case, or it could be anything that would identify it as being you as the owner of that card value. And then we would have you sign the claim form and submit it in, and that's usually the process. We try to keep it very simple if we can.
And one way that she could prove it is she has the card in her hand with the matching number.
That would be, typically that would be a requirement. In some cases, depending if claimant was sure that they'd lost the card, but it existed and they could somehow validate that through the retailer, we may do some sort of an affidavit of loss and pay them on that basis. But that would be the rarity. Typically, it is a bearer instrument, so we're going to hope to get that bearer instrument back as our source of proof.
Further
question: How long does your department keep these funds? How long do you track them? Are they sitting at the Department of State Lands in perpetuity, or they swept occasionally? What happens?
Chair Riley and Senator Thatcher, there's no time limit at this point on unclaimed property. It's an indefinite period that we would hold it, and we actually have things going back to the early 60s in some cases right now. that if errors show up, we would deal with, allow them to claim that those funds at this point.
And can you explain to us where the interest on the money in this account goes?
Okay, yes, Senator Riley and committee, the nice thing about unclaimed property, especially in Oregon, in many states it goes to the right into their general fund. In Oregon, it goes, the funds we collect go into our common school fund, and the interest on those funds actually goes in distributions to K through 12 schools every year. And so it's until the person does show up, the funds do serve a public purpose. And but they're always there available. If everybody showed up tomorrow, we do have the funds on hand to make everyone whole.
Hold up.
Sorry, another question. So in the case of Amazon, they're not headquartered here in Oregon, and you get something like that. Is that additional, how much extra work would it be to sit and sort through which ones are Oregon companies versus out of state and, you know, funneling it over to the proper state?
Thank you for the question, Senator Chair Riley and Senator Thatcher. I honestly don't know exactly how much work that will be. We will have some rulemaking authority under, as this bill indicates, and we would try to work, use that bill making authority to try to create processes that make it work well for everyone involved. Our intent would be that the retailers would not see this as an undue burden from, at least from an administrative viewpoint.
Thank you very much. All right. Oh, Senator Boer.
Thank you, Chair Riley. Do you know how much money currently sits in this account at Division of State Lands?
Yes, thank you, Chair Riley and Vice Chair DeBoer. The current money that we have in the Unclaimed Property Fund is $590 million. That changes daily as we pay out claims, but that's it's steadily growing. The entire Common School Fund, I believe, is over $1 billion at this point. I don't have the exact number.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. So, does anybody else want to weigh in on this bill? Yes, come on up.
Chair Riley, Vice Chair DeBoer, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association. We did submit for the record on OLS a joint statement from my organization, Betsy, with the Retail Council, and Bill Perry with the Restaurant Association. And so we are in opposition to Senate Bill 113. It's an issue that's been around that we've dealt with for over a decade now. And want to just at least go back to the original history in 2007, in which case we kind of brought a lot of these issues around the country on gift cards. And prior to 2007, and I remember the media, and it was a lot of the media around the Christmas time where people did purchase, and again, retailers did this differently all across the country, where you would buy a gift card. You would maybe have a fee associated with that gift card. It may diminish the value over time, so every year it would go down a little bit. And it would have expiration dates. And those expiration dates could range from a year to 3 years to 5 years. In many cases, the consumer may not have known about the expiration date, goes into the retailer, tries to claim the $100 that they received, and they would say, sorry. These were all things that I know from a retail standpoint were unacceptable at the time for our organizations. And so we did work with the legislature in 2007 to craft a bill that we felt was the best for the consumer. I know Consumer Union, when they look around the country at these particular gift card laws, they look at what's best for the consumer. And what we created back in 2007 was no expiration dates and no fees. And so, you know, again, no expiration dates. I have in my top drawer of my thing, I have some Amazon cards too. They've sat there for for a long time. I'll eventually use them. I know Betsy would spend them by tomorrow, but I'm pretty patient, and eventually we'll get to them. But again, there's no expiration dates and no fees attached. So if I have $50 or $100 on that card, 5 years, 10 years from now, whatever, I'm going to get the $50 or the $100 when I redeem them. So those are the two issues that I know from the consumer standpoint was most important to the consumer. The bill puts essentially a de facto expiration date on the bill, 5 years. And when I say that, yes, you can receive the money, and you heard the process involved with receiving that from the state lands, but again, consumer walks to our store, tries to redeem that, whether it's right after the expiration date or the 5 years. We have two choices as a retailer. We can either honor the card no matter what, because they're a customer. We don't like to say no to customers, and so then we would be out the $100, even though we may remit the money, just because we don't want to tell them, sorry, the government has your money, go get it from the government. Because and that's the other alternative, is we can say no, sorry, it has expired, the state has your money, and go to the state and pursue that amount. So that's just from the consumer standpoint, the issues that we're in as retailers with that 5 year period. And so we think we crafted a good pro consumer bill. We're just concerned with putting that de facto expiration date. I know Betsy's going to talk about some of the questions that had just arisen. I'll try to fill in with what I know and what I've learned in the last couple days on how this is dealt with from a lot of the bigger corporations that are out of state, and maybe the access to that money versus not having any access to the money, and the effects on maybe just our smaller retailers. So I'll turn it over to Betsy. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries, OBA, and the Oregon Retail Council. I wasn't sure if we were going to get into this topic today, but since it's already come up about the United States Supreme Court priority rules, I thought I would go into a little bit further and just talk about how the Senate Bill 113 would impact large retailers, multinational retailers, as opposed to kind of smaller local retailers that are selling gift cards just for their one or two stores. In the late 1970s, as the person from State Lands mentioned, the United States Supreme Court developed a set of priority rules that addresses the question of what happens to unclaimed gift card funds. The court's intent in setting out these rules was to resolve once and for all, by a clear rule to which all states may refer with confidence, who has priority in situations where funds on a gift card go unclaimed. So to me, it was a little surprising reading through this line of cases that the United States Supreme Court was addressing what happens to unclaimed gift card funds, but there's a very clear line of cases on the topic. In fact, there's more than one line of cases. Under current law in Oregon, funds are technically never unclaimed because, as Sean mentioned, we don't have an expiration date on the cards, on the gift cards that we sell, ever since 2007. But Senate Bill 113 would effectively undo that prohibition on expiration dates and effectively place a 5 year expiration on those cards from the date of last use. At that 5 year point, as you know, remaining balances would become unclaimed funds, and at that point they would be subject to the Supreme Court's priority rules. The court stated that the first priority for using those unclaimed funds is, of course, the owner. And the owner of a card could be the purchaser, or it could be the person who received the card as a gift. So if the owner is not known, the next party in line is the state where the seller of the card is incorporated, not where it was purchased, but the state where the card, the seller of the card is incorporated. Most large retailers are incorporated outside of the state of Oregon. Some of them have a separate corporation that runs their gift card programs, and some of those gift card program corporations are specifically incorporated in states that do not require the kind of escheat that you are talking about in Senate Bill 113, where funds would need to be returned to the state if they are unused. So what happens is, right now in Oregon, since the funds are never unclaimed, they just remain waiting for the consumer, waiting for the consumer, waiting for the consumer. As soon as you put an expiration date on an unclaimed gift card, they become unclaimed funds, then they end up basically reverting to that large corporation that is out of state and become unavailable for this state or this state's consumers. So what you're really doing, as I look at Senate Bill 113, is disproportionately impacting small retailers that are selling gift cards in this state that are going to have to bear a greater financial burden when you put them in the impossible fix of having their consumer come in and try and redeem an old gift card. I mean, the bill doesn't overturn specifically the prohibition on expiration dates on gift cards. So what you're doing in this bill is leaving the prohibition on expiration dates while also saying that after 5 years, the merchant doesn't have to provide goods or services when they've turned over the unclaimed balance to the Division of State Lands. So like I said, you're putting the merchants in this state, especially smaller local companies that can less afford to lose those unclaimed balances, you know, in an impossible position because you're passing a law or you're contemplating a law that says two things. First of all, you can't put an expiration date. Second of all, here's your expiration date.
Thank you.
We oppose the bill.
Thank you. Clearly, this bill is not ready for prime time. And unless somebody has further questions.
I have a question.
Yes.
So, Betsy, in that scenario, many of us probably get gift cards from family relatives around the country. Mm-hmm. And so if one is purchased in one state, they transfer it to whoever's going to be the recipient of it in a different state. Mm-hmm. It's still going to be controlled by whatever retailer issued the card where they're incorporated, or if they have a separate division that deals with these cards wherever they are located. And that would be the rules. And let's say for myself, if I have the card, I'd have to go to one of those other states and whatever their rules would be as to how I would be able to claim it.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Brzezinski, that's the way we understand it. And I think you may then not have any access to that amount is how we see this. Now, that would be different from, let's say, a small business or, let's say, a small brewery in your hometown who may do their own gift card program, in which case they would apply to this bill and they right. would have access. So there could be some unfairness, to be honest, where there is no access and then some smaller independents that you would have to adhere to this bill. And again, in our research and looking at national retail, there is some cases, and I think the big case comes out of a New Jersey case that kind of decided that particular point. So again, you know, maybe something for legislative council to look at, or, you know, I know these are legal issues, so I don't want to, but it is worth researching that particular point. Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I'm going to close this work session on, actually I didn't open the work session, close the public hearing on Senate Bill 113. And I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 91.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 91 was previously heard on March 1st. This is the measure that removes the state policy and the practical requirement that travel awards earned by state personnel on state business be managed by state agencies to reduce travel costs, declares an emergency effective on passage with an amendment, -1 amendment, that removes the emergency clause. And I believe DAS is here if there are any additional questions.
If there are questions.
There may not be.
Did you want to speak to this?
We don't have
no, I didn't think so. Okay. Any questions about this?
So, Chair Riley, I move the Chair Riley, I move Senate Bill 91 to the floor with the due pass recommendation as amended.
Senator DeBoer moves Senate Bill 91 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
I was wondering about the amendment because I heard an amendment being
I don't think we got the amendment either.
You're
well,
right.
The bill was amended, it's in it, so the current bill has the amendments
amended
in it. There was
previously?
Two amendments. One removed.
Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the script that was provided, it's my error, doesn't have the be adopted for the -1. So he said as adopted as part of the overall motion on the measure. That's the fault is mine and the script is inaccurate. there's a motion to adopt the amendment, and then the motion to move the bill would be the technically accurate way.
So there's actually two amendments.
So it's like two. Done. It's like two motions instead of.
So
one.
So first, to get the amendment that.
Yeah.
So I could retract my motion.
Yeah, let's
or amend it either way.
My apologies to the.
But Chair Riley, I move Senate Bill.
Not the amendment.
91. We accept the two amendments that are.
To have to motion to adopt the amendment into
to
the
adopt
measure.
The amendments into the measure. There's two of them. One was an emergency clause, and
but it's all one. It should be one
it's
amendment.
Just one.
Just
it's
one just amendment.
So that's a dash ones. I'm assuming.
That's correct.
Okay, so let's do this again. Senator DeBoer has moved the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 91. Is there discussion? Yes.
I just, excuse me, want to be very clear that the dash one amendments are all they do is remove the emergency clause. There's right. confusion. I want to make sure that we're that's all that the dash one yeah. amendments do. Great. Okay.
Thank you. Is there objection? It's adopted. Now you can.
Now I'd make a motion to move Senate Bill 91 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
As amended.
Right. Senator DeBoer has moved Senate Bill 91 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Objections? It is going to the floor. Anyone want to carry it? I'll carry it.
It's our first one out, isn't it?
It is.
Yes.
Yeah.
My apologies again to the committee, especially to the vice chair
no problem.
For the confusion.
I mean,
we'll get him a bigger
one. Amended,
you did in the first one.
We'll get him a bigger one.
Okay.
He asked me beforehand not to give it to him.
This was an easy one, too.
And we have one more thing to do. We do have.
Close the work session.
Let me close that work session. I'm going to open a work session for introduction of committee measures.
And Chair Riley, I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills, and that's LC 3184.
Dated
2/22/17.
Senator DeBoer has moved that we introduce LC 3184, dated 2/22/17, as a committee bill. Discussion.
Disclaimer.
Yeah, this, do you want to do that? Go ahead and do the disclaimer. Yeah,
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that by members supporting this motion, they're not indicating how they would vote on the bill if it comes before us as a committee or onto the floor, and we're not committing to any position on the bill itself. It's just a means to allow the bill into the process for future consideration, whether it's in this committee or some other committee that the President refers it to.
Thank you for that. Any other further discussion? Objections? It is adopted. Okay, that's everything we have. I'm going to close the committee. Thank you all. I'm going to close the committee. Thank you all. Okay, that's everything we have.